что такое шестая колонна.
Мы консерваторы, говорят, шестая колонна. Мы
шестая колонна – это те, кто за Путина и за Россию, но при этом
такая же точно пятая, по своим взглядам, но...
Скрытая пятая колонна, поэтому назвал шестая. Мне показалось...
Потому что шестая колонна сдает пятую. Мы послушаем их, они говорят...
Что такое шестая колонна, да?
They've been isolated, they've been marginalized, they've been silenced. Many are living in fear, and some of them have even fled the country. Ever since the Ukraine crisis broke out, and particularly since the patriotic fervor unleashed by the Crimea annexation, Russia's establishment westernizers have been on the outs and on the run. Exiled from the inner sanctum of decision-making, derided as a, quote, sixth column, and devoid of influence in society, Russia's westernizers are clearly down. But are they out? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, guys.
And joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
And also on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean.
Hello, everyone.
And allow me to note that we've managed to put the old band back together for yet another gig. Well, in an interview in RBK this week, former finance minister Alexei Kudrin said Russia's economic crisis will likely be protracted and that, quote, I get the impression that at all levels of power, including at the very top, there is no objective assessment of the challenges that Russia is facing. Back in September, Kudrin told Reuters that he had effectively been excluded from the narrow circle of people who affect decision-making in Russia. And Kudrin is not alone. In a recent article in Politkom.ru, political analyst Roman Larionov wrote that Russia's westernizers have been emasculated across the board in terms of a bureaucratic weight, in terms of informal decision-making circles and in society, and that they've reacted, Larionov wrote, in various ways. Some, like economist Sergei Guriev, have simply fled the country. Some, like Dmitry Medvedev, the prime minister, have become chameleons and have made fools of themselves in the process, pretending that they support policies that everybody knows they don't. Some have opted for public passivity, and some have opted to stick to highly technical issues, like easing business regulations on small business. Mark, why don't you get the ball rolling here and address the question I set out at the intro? The westernizers clearly are down. Are they out?
For the moment, yes, I think they are out. I don't think we should necessarily weep too bitterly for them, because we've got to bear in mind that we're talking about people who benefited really quite substantially in the earlier Putin times. These are people who have options. They can leave the country, flee the country, obviously, or just find other interests. They can keep their heads down, or they can remain part of the fringes and the substructure of politics. This is not a totalitarianism after all. There is room, as long as you don't cross certain red lines, for continuing to sort of say your things. But yes, in terms of them as an independent or an autonomous political force, they are absolutely out. But I think that this sixth column, and one wonders just how many columns Russia wants, but this sixth column does perform a particular function still. First of all, it keeps certain issues in play. Actually having them discussing certain problems, certain issues, means that it becomes part of the political narrative, whether the Kremlin likes it or not, which means that it becomes easier for other forces to talk about it. So in some ways, in that respect, they are the icebreakers, they are the point men. Secondly, I think they, and again, it's a sort of a parallel role, they act as in some ways the stalking horses and the political cover for other, rather more from the Kremlin's point of view, dangerous forces, particularly the insider, the disloyal sort of insiders who in due course are going to be expressing their views. And we've already seen, in the second half, we're going to be talking about some sort of possibilities for critiques of the Putin project coming from the sorts of quarters which usually would support him. So the point is, you might say, In and of themselves, the Westernizers have very, very little power. And no one at the moment can really ally themselves with them because they are, to use this sort of phrase, a toxic, toxic brand. But just by their presence, they allow certain issues to be discussed. They allow certain themes to be in public discussion and indeed political discussion. And that, I think, does perform an important purpose.
And to explain this sixth column business, it was in the clip we played at the outset. Yeah, the Russian media has taken to calling people within the regime that are pro-Western a sixth column. I guess the fifth column must be just the traditional non-systemic opposition. But the guys on the inside who, like, sympathize with the West, they're the sixth column. It's this.
Of course, the dangerous element are going to be the seventh column.
Yeah, who are the seventh columnists?
They are going to be the pragmatic Putinists. Who finally turn against Putin because they want to preserve the system that decide that he has become.
This is like a Robert Ludlum novel. Sean, what do you think? Are the Westerners are down? Are they out? How do you see this?
I mean, they clearly are, and they have been fading from view since Putin came back to the presidency. I think in a kind of wider context, the isolation of Westernizers within the Russian government, here we're speaking of the elite, is really, it seems to me, a reaction to the Medvedev years. And this is accelerated, of course, with Ukraine, but I think it symbolizes a lot of things. First, it symbolizes a kind of wider undeclared anti-cosmopolitanism campaign within Russia itself. I mean, here you have not only the isolation of kind of Western-leaning elites, you also have the kind of rooting out of Western liberal values in general in Russian society. And we see this with kind of this patriotic rhetoric, this kind of reaffirm of Russian culture and Russian national pride. And we also see this, it seems to symbolize to me a strict ideological turn that has occurred since Putin has come back to power, where we've been saying for many years Putin has lacked an ideology, but here we see the final development of a kind of ideology based on patriotism and some understanding of what Russia is and what Russian identity is. And the last thing it seems to symbolize for me is a polarization of political rhetoric in Russia, where you're either with us or against us, hence the rhetoric of this kind of sixth column, and the regulation of these kind of more critical voices to, say, elements in the Russian press that aren't widespread, you know, places like Vyedomosti and other places, but they're not really having any impact within the circles of power.
All right. Kirill?
Just counting the columns, it's like, you know, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Do you remember this book? Yeah. And we'll back to the seventh column, as Mark told us. First of all, we must speak about the very terminology when we call these people Westernizers, or, you know, modernizers, or agents, or modernization, which is, you know, quite popular in some semi-academic publications and so on. It's all disguising the fact that all liberals, even liberals, yeah. It's all these things, they're disguising the fact that they are not, first of all, strictly speaking, Westernizers. They are not agents of modernization, because there is no any real modernizationist, you know, colonial, post-colonial, you know, meaning of this word. And they are not, definitely, they are not liberals. I think we can call them the agents of economic and political common sense.
Some called them technocrats in the past.
Technocrats, it's not a proper word, because if we speak just about Kudrin and someone else, maybe. But we are speaking about, you know, quite wide group of people who are not all of them, they're economists and so on.
I mean, they're talking about Kudrin, we're talking about Dvorkovich, we're talking about Gref, we're talking about Guriev, we're talking about Medvedev, frankly, as well.
I'm strongly opposing, you know, the very idea that Medvedev is, you know, technocrat, westernizer, liberal.
Well, I know
so
you
on.
Think if, Medvedev is nothing.
Yes, if Medvedev is liberal, you know, I'm like, you know, Miley Cyrus songwriter. Yeah.
everything's relative, Kirill. Everything is relative.
Yeah, yeah, maybe in some sense, but we have to be, you know, inside the limitations of common sense. Turning to our subject, to our topic, of course, they played a very important role in the previous periods of Putin's regime and so on, and they are still playing some role. First of all, don't forget that those who are economists and so on, they're the only professionals in Kremlin or White House and something like that. There are no any other professionals in this field.
Mm-hmm.
All of them, they're professionals. And if you compare, say, you know, Kudrin to Glazyev, you will see that right. is the, you know, the difference between professional. Professional could be, you know, liberal or, you know, a Keynesian supporter or something like this. But he must be professional. Glazyev is not professional. And all those who are opposing the so-called Westernizers and so on, they are not professionals. And that's why if this regime still has, you know, just the remainders of common sense, they must keep them. Secondly, they're playing a very important role in their still quite active relationships with the West. They help Putin to disguise the very nature of this regime.
Oh, but Putin, the nature of this regime isn't disguised anymore. Nobody in the West is fooled.
They still have a sort of room for.
I don't know about that.
I really don't know about that.
I think the mask is off. The mask is off.
Putin still has a delusion that nothing happened. Finally, you know.
Well, but he's about the only one on the planet with that delusion. Mark, you indicated you wanted to get in here.
Yeah, sorry, I was just dwelling for a moment on the notion of you would call it a mask, I would call it a fig leaf. Really, the difference is quite what they're hiding.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was actually worth, just for a moment, parsing this notion of the Westernizers. I think, again, this is following up on what Kirill was saying about sort of actually, you know, who are these people? And maybe, I mean, I would say that we could divide this sixth column into four 1.25s. Because, I mean, there are people who are definitely Westernizers. And I think, actually, Kudrin would fall into that category. I mean, yes, he essentially talks the language of economics, but he's fully aware that how far he is packaging up with that issues of political substructures, the legal elements, and so forth.
And since leaving government, he's talking about politics a lot more in the link between politics and economics.
Exactly. But in that respect, I mean, I think he's actually relatively rare. This is why I think, I mean, I'd agree with Kirill that there is a bit of a problem with talking about Westernizers. Then there's the economic specialists, the oligarchs, but also Dvorkovich, Nabiulina, and so forth, who, again, they are sort of modernizers, but just simply that it's actually very difficult to be a serious economist and not be realizing the limitations of the Putinist system and the importance of the you know, working market and such like. So they are kind of the economic Westernizers. There are the legal modernizers, which one might, you know, Pacha, Kirill, fit Medvedev in. But even, I mean, although he doesn't exactly sound like a Westernizer, but someone like Valery Zorkin at the Constitutional Court, people who basically believe in a law-based state that says it's okay to have nasty laws. A law-based state doesn't have to be a liberal one, but the point is it has to be one that is defined by law, which is, again, it speaks to one aspect of Westernization.
Mm-hmm.
And the final element, and in some ways for me one of the most interesting, are the, shall we say, not technocrats, but shall we say the technical specialists who believe in, you know, effective governance and modernization, who wouldn't for a minute describe themselves as at all Westernizers, but whose professionalism is increasingly implicitly setting them at odds with much of the Putin system. And in this, I would put people like Defense Minister Shoigu or Interior Minister Kolokoltsev, people who definitely are not liberals.
Well, now this group gets, yeah, the more sections of the column you add, the wider this group gets.
This is it. So the question is, as it were, whether we put the emphasis on, I mean, if we're talking liberal, that's nice and sort of, it makes them sound like nicer people, but it obviously excludes most of the people we're talking about. I mean, are any of the oligarchs liberals? I mean, I would say in economic terms, politically, absolutely not. They have no problem with the system when they're benefiting from the system. But if we're talking Westernizers, which, I mean, put it another way, are people who are actively or implicitly opposed to aspects of the Putin regime and therefore would want change, then I think we do see this as actually rather less marginal, rather less wishy-washy a team.
I wanted to go to Sean with this, where I want to go next. And this, because we got a specific kind of historical element here. And that's that, I mean, are the Westernizers a mainstay of the Russian landscape, or are they an aberration? That age-old question, number one. But also, what do other historical periods show us about this? Because there have been periods in Russian history where the Westernizers were ascendant, and there have been periods where they've been, you know, been down and out like they are now. So in terms of both of those questions, are they I think they clearly are a mainstay of the landscape, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. But also, what do other historical periods show us?
Yeah, I think they certainly are a mainstay of the landscape, because they kind of cropped up in various periods of Russian history where they've kind of either existed, behind the scenes, or they've come up to the surface when their advice is needed.
Right. Since Peter the Great, of course.
Certainly, yeah. And I think what Kirill pointed out, this kind of dichotomy between professionalism on the one hand and essentially bureaucrats on the other, is really these people are the kind of professionals who are looking out for the best interests of the state. They are by no means seeking to undermine it, but they're looking at the ways to make the state more efficient, to make the society run better, to make the economy run better. And there have been particularly, historical periods where they've been kind of put aside. And here I'm thinking of right after World War II with the kind of high Stalinist period where any kind of, more technocratic voices were pushed to the side. And then they kind of came up again after Stalin's death. Particularly another period would be the late 70s and early 80s before Gorbachev, where these kind of people were pushed to the kind of undercurrents of Brezhnev politics, but came out gradually under Andropov and then under Gorbachev, of course. So we have this kind of Russian politics in the big elite scale seems to be this dichotomy between kind of more conservative or even more bureaucratic and statist elements and more kind of, say, reformist, technocratic, and professional elements. And these seem to switch depending on the various crises that the state is dealing with.
Do you think history teaches us anything about where the future of today's Russia's Westernizers may be? What the future may be?
I mean, it depends. I think their kind of reascendancy might depend on how deep, say, the economic crisis gets in Russian society and the avenues in which the top elites, and here speaking of Putin in particular, is willing to look for other avenues of escape, to kind of listen to the voices that are certainly that are speaking out periodically in the Russian press, but don't really have any, in trying to influence the kind of parameters of debate on how to deal with various issues in the government and society. But it might take a lot for them to come reascendant, because the way I see it, like I said, since Putin has come back, there has been a marked shift in the rhetoric of and the parameters of political discourse in the country.
Mm. Kirill, what do you think? You're a historian too, and though you hate historical analogies, I'm not asking you for an analogy. I'm just asking you for your thoughts.
There are several traditions in Russian history. Usually people speak about the tradition of slavery, of authoritarian regimes, of monarchy, and so on. But from the 18th century, and especially from 19th century, there is a tradition of, as Sir Isaiah Berlin put it, a history of freedom. I'm not speaking about the Decembrists and so on, but I'm speaking about, the tradition from Chadaev, Gerzen, et cetera. And it's a quite strong tradition. Moreover, it was, quite victorious in the beginning of 20th century. And it's still quite strong now. Especially in the big cities and so on. The problem is that, let's call them, liberals, but, most of them, they were socialists, actually. The problem is their position, traditional position, Russian position between state and so-called Russian people. Between state, which is, as Pushkin put it, the only European in this country, and so-called Russian people, which is by default traditional, orthodox, loving, and so on. So how to play this role? There are two options. Or either you still going on playing Russian liberal or, free thinker and so on, understanding that you are very weak and your place is between, these two huge things like, you know, state and people, or you have to change the game. I think the problem with the, you know, recent Russian liberalism or, you know, free thinkers or westernizers or whoever, that they don't know how to change the very rules of this game, mm-hmm. how to avoid the situation of being between, say, Putin and his supporters from, say, Blagoveshchensk and so on. So, and that is the problem. That is the problem. They don't know. They're still thinking in the terms of historical Russian historical tradition. And that is, the most serious mistake.
Mm-hmm. Mark, your thoughts? I see you writing.
I think it's just really, I want to follow up on what Kirill was saying, because I think he's spot on. I think this is the thing. Liberal westernization in the Russian tradition has always actually been associated implicitly or explicitly with being anti-Russian. It's opposed to Russian traditions. And this is why when you had the sort of the going to the country in the late 19th century of these well-meaning liberals who would go out in the countryside to bring enlightenment to the masses, and the masses would give them a good beating and right. hand them over to the police. And I think this is, for me, one of the sort of the fundamental problems. Can this iteration of westernizers actually, I wouldn't say create a Russian westernization, because that comes back to the usual points about Russia being an exceptional right. country and so forth. But rather, can they either tap into the genuine beliefs and desires of the Russian people and say, no, you are Western too, and this is what we're going to do about it, or can they at least find some way of packaging what it is that they want to sell to the Russian people? Mm-hmm. Because, again, there is no intrinsic Russian model. It is more that at the moment Putin is far, far more effective in speaking to certain traditions and encouraging, creating, generating, and furthering others. So the westernizers still look like the outsiders. They are indeed allowing themselves to be painted as the sixth column, rather than being the loyal Russians.
Right. Well, it's kind of hard for them to play the role of loyal Russians in the current circumstances.
And I would say they're not even speaking to the average Russians. I mean, these people are speaking – the people we're speaking about are speaking to the elite.
Yeah.
You know, they're publishing – Kudrin is not speaking to the guy on the street and out in the provinces. He's speaking to people like himself within the government who can affect policy. He's trying to have influence on the right. highest levels. I mean, here I think the analogy with the kind of young socialists and social revolutionaries who went to going to the people in the 1960s is a completely different kind of social class in terms of the political hierarchy right. of Russian society. I mean, here we're speaking of the – if we're speaking of the westernizers, it seems to me we're speaking of the kind of top elites.
In a lot of ways, this is a battle for the hearts and minds of the elite right now, if you look at it that way. And one of the things I wanted to touch on was, does the failing economy help or harm the westernizers' prospects within the elite and within the public, but primarily within the elite? I mean, Sean, what do you think? What do you think about that? You touched on it a little bit earlier, but as the economy gets worse, does that make the prospects of somebody like a Kudrin or a Gref or a Dvorkovich, does that make them more influential within the elite?
I mean, I think it all depends on the direction in which the Putin and his circle wants to take to get out of the crisis. If they want to kind of double down on you know, the statism.
Which will only deepen the crisis.
Which could only deepen the crisis, but they think they can muddle through it and something miraculous will happen and the oil prices will go up or something like this and kind of pull themselves out of it. Or, you know, they could look to these kind of elements that are on the fringes of the elite and look for new ideas. The thing is what's the trigger that's going to make them look to new ideas?
Mark, what do you think?
I mean, very briefly, because I know Kirill has some things to say. I mean, I would say that we have to bear in mind that the kind of reforms that a Kudrin would want to bring in the short term, are going to mean pain for Russians. Sure, one can talk about taking money away from the defense budget and such like. And in the long term, it may well mean a proper, serious and self-sustaining economic recovery, and indeed more than just recovery for Russia. Absolutely. But in the short term, this is not a popular or populist approach. And so I think, likewise, we actually have to distinguish between the short and the long-term implications of the economic crisis. In the short term, I think actually it means that the regime has no option but to double down. I think at this point they've basically ruled out any kind of intrinsic reform models. I'd like to believe it could be otherwise, but I think that's where we are. And therefore, implicitly, the modernizers are increasingly disloyal. They are increasingly opposed to the government line, and therefore they're increasingly marginalized. The point is that the economic crisis in the long term will undermine the regime and create another opportunity for a redefinition of Russian policy, which, as we said in previous podcasts, need not be in the democratic liberal model, but it is at least another throw of the dice.
Right.
It is another chance, perhaps, for a liberal model to emerge.
So their chances come not under this regime, but under any future regime that comes in.
Well, in a way, their chances become precisely because the economic crisis is more likely to bring this regime down.
Kirill, I know you had something to say.
I agree. Of course, future... I'm absolutely sure that it will happen. Future crisis, real, you know, financial, economic crisis, you know, will lead to some redefining of political system. And this is a chance for liberals or westernizers or whoever, for the, you know, people of common sense. But in this case, they must invent political language, how to speak to so-called, you know, common people and so on. Just one story. I remember in the beginning of 90s, in the very beginning of Yegor Gaidar reforms and so on, he came to some of Russian provincial towns to explain, you know, this new economic policy to such as, you know, plain people of Russia. And one of the babushkas, you know, old lady, asked him, do you believe in God? He told her, actually, I'm an agnostic, but at some points I'm close to Protestantism. That is, you know, to Calvinism or something. That is a very good example of how they cannot speak to, you know, so-called plain people or ordinary people or common people and so on. They're somewhere, you know, outside, mentally, outside this country. And that is the problem.
Kirill, I'm going to stick with you, and before we move on to the second section, I want to say something you and I had a conversation off mic yesterday, and you were saying the true westernizers are not these people you name, these people like Gref and Kudrin, but they're the liberal institutions that are trying to bring up a new generation. Places like the Moscow Higher School of Economics, places like the Smolny College of Liberal Arts in St. Petersburg, and so on. Right now, these institutions are not in the best shape either, and I wanted you to maybe speak to that a little bit and see if you can give us a little bit to talk about before we move on to the next topic.
Of course, this institution now are, you know, relatively under fire. Of course, they're a bit insecure and so on. They're trying to survive somehow, and there are different ways how to survive. For instance, High School of Economics, they try to include into the ranks some quite dubious people from academic circles who are not definitely liberals and so on, and that's how they are trying to survive. The same I could speak about Smolny College. Some other institutions are just trying to avoid, you know, political discussions and so on, trying to concentrate on their you know, work as a pedagogical institutions or like the numerous centers for contemporary arts in Russia. Most of them, they are financed by state, by the way. They are, you know, state centers for contemporary arts. Just, you know, compare the mindset of such people like Medinsky and the very idea of the Center for Contemporary Art.
It's funny you should mention Medinsky. Sorry to interrupt you. I don't know if any of you saw Medinsky's interview in Izvestia today, where he was finally said what he thought of the film Leviathan, the Oscar-nominated film Leviathan, which remarkably was partially funded by the culture minister, although we found out the decision was made before Medinsky came in. But he said that we should have films that don't have so much existential angst. And I was thinking Russian like culture without existential angst. What is that? Sorry to interrupt you. I just, when you said Medinsky, I could not help but think of that Izvestia interview today.
Speaking seriously, you know, Medinsky, such people like Medinsky, is a very good chance, the very existence of them in the government and so on, is a very good chance for liberals to be patriotic. Because the very position, the very point of view of Medinsky is the result of, you know, a sort of mind which is shaped by Hollywood culture. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's not about Russian culture. It's not even about Soviet culture. It's, you know, it's he's just a guy from GIMO Institute for Foreign Affairs and Relations, GIMO, yeah, who just, you know, watched a lot of American series and Hollywood movies about happy people who are doing happy things and so on. And I just, you know, it's a very good gift for real liberals and westernizers, because they can support and defend their own national culture and national tradition. And that is very serious. Mm-hmm. And returning to the westernizers institutions, their fate in Russia and so on, we can say that they are surviving because Putin himself and the regime showed them their very place of how, or the very way how they could survive. It's very interesting. It's not a totalitarian regime. It's authoritarian regime. Inside this sort of regime, there are some pockets.
Shrinking pockets, as we discussed last week.
Anyway,
but pockets.
Anyway, still. And they try to hide in these pockets and try to do their, you know, what they ought to do as a professionals, by the way. When we speak about curators of contemporary art, when we speak about the educational system and so on. And they try to survive to hibernate and then to resurrect or, you know, to revive after, you know, this high spirit will be over. Mm. I think that that is their own idea of how to.
Mark, Sean, any thoughts on these institutions, which may be more important than the individuals at the end of the day?
Yeah, I would say that this is the point. But institutions are made up of individuals. And I absolutely agree with Kirill that in many cases, people are kind of hunkering down. And in some ways, the parallel I tend to think of is Glasnost. When you had this extraordinary flourishing of really quite fascinating and dynamic journalism, culture, etc., as soon as the pressure was resisted. In other words, there were people who, up to that point, it's not as if they had been previously boilermakers, who suddenly, as soon as they had the opportunity, became cultural figures. They had been working within the system. They had been preserving, maintaining, and nurturing their ideas.
And living
and then
a double life.
As soon as they had the opportunity. Well, yeah, I suppose a double life, but who doesn't? But as soon as they had the opportunity, they could then reveal it. I think this is what's happening now. I mean, we should realize that the opportunities for expression may well be shrinking. And you've got, I don't know, Medusa opening up in Riga as a way of precisely maintaining your freedom of expression because by getting the hell out of Dodge. But a lot of those things are still there within what we might think of as the sort of the middle class, the lower elite, and so forth. I think a lot of the opinions, a lot of the beliefs are fundamentally westernizing, even if they can't express it. And so it's there dormant, ready to rise up again.
So going back to the original question at the beginning, the westernizers are down and out, but not really out, I guess, if you broaden it out a bit.
They're down, but in.
Down, but in.
I mean, Russian academia, if we're speaking of academic institutions, particularly in cultural institutions, have been in this situation before, in the sense that they have to find – they're given certain parameters in which to maneuver in, and those parameters are shrinking, and they have to find ways of doing their work seriously if they're serious academics. The serious ones are finding ways to do their academic work. Maybe they're not able to, say, publish openly or in certain places as they used to, but they may be published elsewhere. Maybe they'll publish abroad. Maybe they won't publish at all and continue discussions in kind of more informal ways between academics. So it's basically, I mean, for academics, it's finding a language and a means in which to do their work until, as Mark said, time comes where the parameters will open up again, and then we kind of get this flourishing of knowledge.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll shift to the second segment. In a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion and look at some eyebrow-raising remarks made by a man considered to be the wise old man of Russian politics. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from London is Kirill Kobudin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Российский экс-премьер Евген Примаков.
Признание Донбасса территории Украины и вести переговоры с западными
партнерами. То, что Примаков это сказал, в этом никакой новости.
Фактически ликвидацию Российской Федерации,
говорит. Я прошу комментировать то, что говорил вчера Примаков. Когда он сказал, что Москва
Россия
обязана...
должна держать двери открытыми для США и НАТО в противовес.
Это сказал Примаков.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but Evgeny Primakov's comments this week made my jaw drop. I mean, really. Primakov, of course, said that Russia should recognize Donbass as part of Ukraine, repair its relations with the West, diversify its economy, and decentralize the political system. And he also said Russia faces no real threat of a colored revolution. I don't know how many Kremlin talking points you can go, well, except for the Donbass thing, which is actually official policy right now, but it's stated at least. But I mean, I don't know, he went against Kremlin talking points on the colored revolution thing, especially. This kind of blew my mind. I mean, Primakov is no liberal westernizer, to put it mildly. The guy's got a background in the security services. He enjoys the respect of Vladimir Putin, and they are closer than one would think. Mark, what did you make of this?
I think it was very interesting. I do believe this is the first little Lego brick building up that seventh column that I mentioned of people within the system who are beginning to think, actually, we've taken a wrong turn and we have to do something about it, whether or not Putin is or is not part of that shift. Because precisely, Primakov, fascinating figure, not just ex-prime minister, but also clearly...
Silovik
through and through, but not... shall we say, the strong-arm type Silovik,
right.
Very much the Andropovian, relatively urbane intelligence rather than violence sort of model. And my view has always been that his relationship with Putin is an essentially sort of pragmatic one, and it's more that Putin respects Primakov necessarily than vice versa.
Exactly.
I've got to bear in mind that part of the whole reason why Putin was brought in as prime minister and heir apparent in 1999 was to head off the bloc that seemed to be emerging, Primakov, Moscow Mayor Lushkov, and so forth.
But as soon as Putin won, one of the first things he did was bring Primakov to the Kremlin and greet him and make it clear that he was on the ins.
Absolutely, because Putin did not want to be opposed to that particular fraction. And certainly the people, Putin's people at the FSB, were very much Primakov friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So he was getting that from signal. And Primakov was and is a canny operator and therefore knew that he wasn't going to start picking wars with the Kremlin then, which is interesting why he's doing it now. And very much my suspicion, and it's purely, a suspicion is his way of saying guess, hopefully educated. My suspicion is that in this respect, Primakov is precisely being used as the person who can articulate concerns about policy on behalf of the smarter, more thoughtful, if not necessarily more liberal, Silovik, because he is exactly the sort of the grand old man of security politics. Mm-hmm. He is pretty safe. He has a relatively iconic status within precisely the kind of people whose respect Putin wants, and therefore he feels he can do these things.
Now, Mark, your guesses are always very educated. I mean, do you think this is a challenge to Putin's Kremlin, or it's a orchestrated attempt to shift policy?
I would definitely say it is the latter. I don't think we're talking about it.
The because former,
if, even if you look, well, I mean, I, it's not a challenge to the Kremlin. It's simply an attempt to say, we think we've taken a wrong path, it's not impossible to retrace our steps and take the right path. Very much everything Primakov said was couched in terms of politics, not people.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I think this is why he's speaking up the way he is, because he cared. No one thinks that Primakov has his eye on the presidency.
Right.
He's
85 years old, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he's made it clear that that's not a route that he would be thinking of taking. So I think it's just simply that this is it. He's the loyal opposition who can say, time to do something different.
Do you think it was sanctioned by Putin? I mean, it did run in the Rossiyskaya Gazeta.
I don't think it was sanctioned by Putin, but I didn't think Putin was going to stop it.
Mm. Kirill, what did you think? I mean, this is you've been watching Primakov for a long time. What do you think?
I'd like to return to our topic of people of common sense. There are several types of people of common sense in Russian politics. Some of them technocrats or liberals or economists and so professionals. Primakov, in some sense, he is a professional. I have a lot of friends, older friends, who worked with him when he was a head of Institute of Oriental Studies in Moscow in the end of 1960s, and they praised him. Being dissidents and so on, and he was not a dissident. He's very smart, he's, very experienced and so on, and he's one of the best examples of Secret Service nobility in Soviet Union and in post-Soviet Russia. And I think a huge difference between Putin, who looks like, young hooligan on the background of Primakov and, people like him, I think that Primakov now is one of those who still have this sort of old-fashioned but still very actual common sense of people who are interested in national interests. Mm-hmm. Sorry for such, long phrase.
Well, no, once something, the way he couched his comments as I read them in the press, I still haven't seen actual video or audio or heard audio of these comments, but what I read was in Kommersant and in the Rossiyskaya Gazeta, but it was all couched in terms of national interest. All of
yes.
it. The rapprochement with the West, where he was saying that Russia needs to repair its relations with the West, diversify its economy, decentralize the political system. This was all couched in terms of national interests.
Yes, because, that's, our favorite idea that this podcast, that people who are surrounding Putin now, they are not acting in support of national interests. They are following their own interests. They're not real politicians. And Primakov, he is a real politician. We could, dislike him, think about himself as a, political enemy and so on. But he is a real, statesman.
Mm-hmm.
In Soviet terms, maybe in post-Soviet terms, but he's thinking not about his assets in Switzerland and so on. He's thinking about the very existence of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, and this is the point of common sense, he is very disappointed with, the things, how they're happening now. And that's, I think, the reason why he tried to, to make public concerns.
Yeah, I would love to know the backstory behind this, because it must be really fascinating. Sean, what were your thoughts? How did you react to Primakov's comments?
Well, Russia doesn't have that many elder statesmen. So it's always interesting when one speaks up and kind of playing the role of an elder statesman, kind of providing some, advice to the ruler to kind of think about things differently. But I find it interesting that these comments were made public, and I wonder what's the significance of him making them public rather than saying.
Well, they were made at the speech at the Mercury Club. It's an annual speech he gives every year. It doesn't always make news. I mean, when Primakov talks, people it does make minor news. It doesn't always make news like it did here, but he doesn't always say things like this.
Right.
He says things you expect him to say in past ones. Here, I this could have been Kudrin talking.
Right. You know? I mean, in many respects, it's not really, maybe some of the details of the comments, but it's in the same vein of what Kudrin's been saying periodically over the last year to some extent. And it's interesting to kind of the role that I see this playing, Primakov being an elder statesman in Russian politics, being a politician, as Kirill put forward, he's kind of trying to open up some kind of public debate, at least amongst policymakers, through making these comments. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, how, if there's any reaction at all in kind of the public discourse or the public policy discourse about what he's put forward.
I mean, I saw some interesting speculation on the Twitter after these comments were made. There is no factual basis that I know of for any of this. But somebody tweeted, you know, it's known that it's suspected that the White House is using Henry Kissinger as a possible back channel to Russia. I don't know if that's true or not, but there is speculation about that. And they said maybe Russia's using Primakov and, you know, those two old war horses can, you know, basically sit down and hash a lot of this out. I don't know if there's anything to that. I want to make clear this is all just people speculating on Twitter. But it did raise it was kind of fascinating to think about. Mark, do you see any, I mean, maybe, do you think maybe perhaps Primakov's audience was the West?
I don't think so. What possible value just from having sort of someone saying there is some person who in Russia who thinks that they could be
not
sort of
Western policymakers, Russia people?
No, I mean, I think, to be honest, if it comes down to it, I mean, I think I would just disagree with Sean one point on terms of saying that Primakov was trying to open up public debate. I mean, I don't think is the case. I think that Primakov realizes full well that the only debate that matters is actually the private debate. Mm. And in this respect, I mean, absolutely, I mean, he is the elder statesman. In some ways, I think what Primakov having to use this medium shows is precisely that they have atrophied all the avenues for internal discussion. Mm-hmm. Public debate is the last worst option, not the first option for someone like Primakov. He, I'm sure, would rather have had a cozy chat over tea with Putin. But if he can't do that, and no one can these days, unless you happen to be in that very, very inner circle of, as Kirill said, people who are more interested in their Swiss bank accounts, then basically you have to have that dialogue through Rossiyskaya Gazeta, which is a worrying thing, but it's an encouraging thing that there are people who still try to use these other channels to get purchase into the channels that really matter.
Yeah, and if you remember on previous podcasts, Ben Judah was pointing out that these internal lines of communication have indeed broken down. People aren't even using smartphones anymore, a lot of people in the elite, because they're afraid of being listened to. They're using, like, throwaway Nokias from the 90s, right? To me, the other thing that's interesting is, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, now that's the official government paper. Medvedev is, you know, titularly at least the head of the government. You got to wonder if, I mean, I don't know, how did this get into Rossiyskaya Gazeta, right? Because it's a little different from it getting into Kommersant, which you expect it to get into. It's a little different from it getting into Izvestia, which would be seen, which is, I mean, is not just a pro-Kremlin paper. It's a Putin paper. It's as close to the party line as you can possibly get, even though it's nominally private. Rossiyskaya Gazeta is a different animal. It's a funny different animal, and again, the decision to put this there was very interesting. It didn't get wide coverage on state television. This did. We managed to string together a few things. But it didn't get wide coverage on state television. But it was in the Rossiyskaya Gazeta, and that really, really raised my eyebrows. Kirill, any thoughts about that? About the media pickup on this and what that signifies?
Just speculations. Just imagine if such a text would be published in Kommersant.
It was.
Yes, but Rossiyskaya Gazeta.
Oh.
You're asking about Rossiyskaya Gazeta. Rossiyskaya Gazeta, it's a proof that this is not just, you know, liberal rubbish for the audience. Kommersant is a bit suspicious.
Right.
Izvestia is becoming more and more yellowish, and the, you know, newspaper whose columnists are, you know, Dugin, Limonov, and so on, isn't serious. Komsomolskaya Pravda, you know, it's just impossible because it's not about...
Rossiyskaya gives it some kind of official stamp.
Yes, it's an official stamp. At the same time, it's quite moderate, by the way, if you, you know, regularly read it. And moreover, it's, you know, a bit distanced from this propaganda war. And it's a very special place. I think they consciously keep it for such occasions. and we'll keep it, you know, till some period, for some period, and so on. Of course, that's just a speculation.
Yeah, but, no, that's anyway, which is all we can do right now, because this. I mean, I was just fascinated by this. I did a daily vertical on it because I found it so fascinating. Mark, Primakov, as you pointed out, and I noted, is a Siloviki. He is the grand old man of the Siloviki. Do you think this shows some kind of this kind of discord in that camp over Russia's direction?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there have been smaller, more subtle signals of disquiet. You know, we shouldn't tend to assume that the professional spooks and soldiers necessarily are always going to be the hawks. Because if nothing else, they're the ones who are going to be on the front line of the wars, overt, covert, declared and undeclared, that might then emerge. And therefore, precisely, I think that a role of a Silovik statesman like Primakov is that he can express certain concerns, that if you're in the general staff, that if you're in one of the intelligence agencies, you really cannot, both because it's career suicide, but secondly, because you have no channels to do that. If Primakov wants to be in Rossiyskaya Gazeta, he can be in Rossiyskaya Gazeta. Mm. If you are the head of a division within the SVR or the FSB, you can't, and you won't. Mm. So that's why they needed someone like Primakov.
All right, well, before we wrap up, I want to throw one last question to everybody. I mean, is this one of those signals that might, and this is perilous territory, speculation territory and all that stuff, but that's what we do. Is this one of those signals that might portend a policy shift? On the Daily Vertical, I said, is this, you know, an indication that Russia may be seeking a face-saving way out of the Ukraine crisis, seizing on the Donbass comments? But I would even say broader, is it trying to find a face-saving way out of the suicidal path that it's embarked on over the past year? Don't all jump at once.
I don't think so, because I don't think the audience was for outside of Russia. I think it was for a very internal audience, and I don't know what kind of signal it represents. It might represent a signal in terms of what Mark has put forward, but I don't think it's a signal coming from, say, the Kremlin, is to feel out a kind of a safe face-saving way out of the situation.
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Sean. I think that this is not some kind of signal from the Kremlin or a sign of likely policy change. I don't think there's going to be any substantial policy change so long as Putin is in the Kremlin now. I think it's more that when, in due course, historians write the story of the end of Putinism, they will probably pick up on this as one of the first signs we had precisely of the tectonic shifts taking place under the mantle that, in due course, led to Putin's downfall. Mm.
Kirill, last word to you.
I think all that we're speaking about this is 100% good old Kremlinology of 1978.
It's all we can do now, because we're back to 1978.
Yes. But my,
I feel
opinion,
15 again.
Speculations that I think it's one of the signs, not such numerous, but anyway, of the, you know, mild and quite calm chaos which is overtaking the political elite now in Russia. Just one of the signs, and not such important, but the importance of it, of this, is, you know, is more serious for observers than for, you know, real politics. But who knows?
Who knows indeed, but we'll probably find out soon enough. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Also on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion. It's great to have the old band back for another gig.
Great to be back.
Thanks.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly released Power Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.